Hello and welcome to The Nature Between Us, a podcast for all your eco inquiries and musings. My name is Tessa. I'm an Aussie actress, voiceover artist, and environmental master's student on a mission to demystify the big environmental issues of our time. Join me on my quest to find solutions and positivity from the wide variety of people working towards a more sustainable future. This podcast is recorded and produced on Bidjigal and Gadigal land of the Eora Nation, and I acknowledge the traditional owners and pay my respects to elders past, present, and emerging. This is episode number 5, and I gotta say, guys, I'm not even close to being sick of that jazzy intro song. It is so catchy. I love it. I bop along. I'm really sorry to anyone out there who hates it because it's not going anywhere. I might even start putting more of it in. It'll just slowly become an entire jazz song. Anyway, I digress. This episode is all about big weather and how immersive technology is helping us to adapt. Now, I've had to taper in my weather puns because extreme weather is snow joke. In the past 20 years, there has been a staggering rise in the frequency and intensity of extreme weather events. It's the kind of stuff the climate scientists have been predicting for decades and the kind of stuff that we're already experiencing now. But I was curious how it all works. Like, how exactly is a warming climate responsible for these big weather events? And how can we adapt to be more resilient in the face of them? So this ep is kind of special because there's not just one, but two guests. The first is Nathan Byrne, who you might already be familiar with because he's on the telly most mornings giving us our forecasts as ABC's News Breakfast weatherman. He's also a meteorologist, oceanographer, and Navy lieutenant. And the second, Emma Morris, a good friend of mine and an award-winning documentary producer/director, immersive technology geek, and the brains behind a new augmented reality experience called Mount Resilience. We discuss our craziest weather experiences, the power of technology for science communication, how Mount Resilience came about, and heaps of weather stuff like cyclones, sand sculptures, warming atmospheres, and the El Niño and La Niña effect. Enjoy! Thank you to both of you for carving out an hour of your very busy and important days to talk about big weather. Sydney looks like it's experiencing some big weather right now.
It definitely is, and there is never any problem with asking me to talk about big weather. In fact, it's harder to get me to stop. So feel free anytime to be like, Nate, enough. You're getting a bit too excited about the weather.
I concur with that.
I thought a fun place to start would be to hear about both of your, one experience that you've had that really stuck with you of really big, wild weather.
It's actually an experience I had when I was a teenager. I think I was about 16 in North Carolina. We were staying down there on holiday and we were part of this huge, massive storm. And it felt like a mini tornado, but it wasn't. But it was just so hectic. And the lightning, we were staying right on the coast. So I've never heard anything so loud in my life. Like the lightning was so dramatic and so beautiful, but really, really scared. Like I was petrified. And it lasted through most of the night. And then in the morning we went out and actually I was reminded of this by my mom that they actually created an eight. You probably know what this is, but when the lightning hits the sand and it creates those massive, amazing, beautiful, almost sculptures.
Yeah, because it's so hot.
Shards of glass.
Yeah. It literally just melts the silicon in the sand and turns it into glass. Yeah.
Yeah. So we went hunting the next day. Yeah.
How cool. They're like a lightning sand sculpture.
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. And how old were you at that point?
I think I was 16.
Okay. Cool. So you were like old enough to understand like what was going on, but still young enough to be like, this is crazy.
Yeah. It felt like something out of a movie, you know. It was just hectic.
Oh, wow. And Nate, what about you? You surely have experienced some wild weather in your time on the boats in the Navy.
Yeah. And there's so many big like weather things that I think about, like even some tiny things that were still pretty impressive. But like I remember being on a mine hunter off the coast of New South Wales trying to drive the ship like late at night, and it was just, you know, complete ocean out of the window, then complete sky out of the window as we're like, you know, just going up these huge waves and rolling all over the place. But I think there's that, the massive red dust storm that Sydney had, that always sticks to my mind because I was cleaning dust out of my apartment for months. But I think really for me, one of the really strong memories I have, I'm a Perth boy originally, and over on that side of the country, the cold fronts come in like pretty regularly during winter. And as a kid, we'd go down to the local boat harbour and like park the car at the, like on the top of the cliff sort of thing, and see the storms rolling in and try to time it perfectly. So we'd be watching the rain come in, and then, you know, Dad would be like, now, and we'd run back to the car and try and jump in the car before the rain hit us. So probably not like the most impressive thing, but that's one of the, like the early memories that really sticks with me. It's really warm because as soon as we heard storms were coming, we'd be like, Dad, can we go watch? It was probably incredibly dangerous being out there on top of a cliff, but it was so much fun.
Yeah, I remember really vividly the summer storms hitting when I was a kid as well. And I remember my dad, because I grew up in a family of surfers, and so it was always like, oh, there's a storm coming. You know what that means, that there's going to be no wind and the surf's going to be really good. And so we'd like, if it was hailing, if it was lightning, like we'd just be out in the surf. And I'm like, looking back, that's probably not very safe. But it was so like, yeah, it's so exciting to be like, not just experiencing the storm because storms are really fun and scary and exhilarating, but to be like actually in the middle of it, surfing. And yeah, I think I felt safe because I was in a rubber wetsuit, and for some reason I thought that gave me insulation or something.
Yeah, look, if you're going to get hit by lightning though, because it's not like you're entirely encased in rubber, you'd probably not do so well.
Yeah, but, no.
Hey, fish managed to survive, so.
Yeah. And Nate, you've wanted to be a weatherman since I read online, since you were like 5 years old or something.
Yeah, but not for good reasons.
Originally. Okay. Why did you want to be a weatherman?
Well, because I knew that you had to have a job when you were a grown up. And, I think when I figured that out, I didn't realise that different jobs had different. I just thought you needed to have some kind of job. And I sort of looked around the world and around me and realised that the weatherman did what, like 3 or 4 minutes of work a day on the news. and so I think the way that my brain went was, oh, that means extra time to play. Now, as an actual weather presenter, I can tell you that is not the case. Not 3 minutes. I get about 3 minutes to myself a day.
Yeah. So what does a day in the life of a weatherman actually look like?
Oh, well, it it depends on what flavor of weather presenter you are, but in my version of things, I do breakfast, so it involves an incredibly early start, somewhere between sort of 2 a.m and 3 or 3:30 a.m. That is when I get out of bed. The advantage I have is that, you know, as a forecaster, I always know what my day is going to look like, so I can set my alarm appropriately. And if it's a big weather day, like if there's a cyclone coming in or some severe storms or something, then I can, you know, get up early, so I make sure I've got my head in the game really well. So by the time I get into the office, I'm the expert in the room. So because as soon as I walk in, especially if there's, you know, dangerous fire weather or something, I always want to know what's going on. So it's best that I've spent some time figuring out beforehand. And then I'm on telly until 11 in the morning. But
yeah,
like at summer, like, you know, during the summer bushfires this year, there were times when I was on telly until like 2:30 in the afternoon.
Because yeah,
if it's dangerous and things are going crazy, just try and stop me from helping people as much as I can, you know?
Yeah, totally. And so this is a bit of a naive question perhaps, but you are obviously, you're a meteorologist and an oceanographer. You've got a degree in physics and also a master's in science communication.
Yeah.
But are some weather people not necessarily meteorologists and more presenters, and you are more of a science meteorologist who's like taken to presenting?
Yeah. So I'm happy to be corrected, but there are very few meteorologists on national television. It's not typically been something that's been required, and that's sort of a unique feature of Australian TV, because for a long time, you know, in the 50s and 60s, when we sort of started putting weather presenters on TV, it was all about mostly being a pretty lady, was the big push. And that's sort of stayed the case in Australia. You know, in the US and in the UK, they always turn to meteorologists first, whereas here that's not the case. And even with the ABC, when I applied for the job, they were looking for a journalist with an interest in weather. So when I saw it, I called and said, I'm not what you're looking for. I'm the exact opposite, but what do you reckon?
They're like, well, we love you. We'll take you.
Well, I don't know if they loved me straight away. They had to reteach me how to not speak military because I came straight from the Navy where I was a forecaster.
Oh, okay.
The ABC. Had a lot of learning to do.
What does speak military sound like?
Oh, there's lots of weird things you learn in the military, like calling toilets heads. Yeah, for example, it's speaking, you know, saying a lot of like Roger and I've learned how to be a civilian though. It's taken me a few years, but I'm there now.
You've acclimatized, no pun intended. So obviously today we're talking about big weather, but we're also talking about this very cool new AR experience that Emma, you have been just working away like an absolute mad woman to get off the ground. And it's all about big weather hitting our cities and how we can adapt and become more resilient. And it's to coincide with an ABC series that maybe some of the listeners have heard called Big Weather. I'd love to hear a bit about that and how it all came to be.
Yeah, so as you said, it's part of Big Weather and How to Survive It. It was conceived in an editorial meeting with the Big Weather filmmakers, basically. And I think I've told you this, that it was during the bushfires in California, there was a town and basically they'd signed this new Green Chico deal to basically rebuild the whole entire town called Paradise.
I've heard about this, or maybe you told me, Emma. It's so
I might have told you, yeah. And, you know, I have a love of immersive media, particularly VR, and AR is new, is sort of a new medium, particularly in this sort of like longer format stuff as well that we've managed to nail with this project. But it just inspired me to think like so many of the problems that we face are hindered based on existing systems, the way that we do things, how our governments are structured, the way that we built our cities, the way that we live in them, and some of the decisions that we make on a daily basis or, you know, even a yearly basis. What if we started again? How would we reimagine how we would live? And that's what this town's trying to do in California, like, and down to jobs and transport and everything. And it's not just, I guess, like the further along we got, I realized that it's a much bigger and more complex issue than just the design of our cities. And it really comes back to how we live in them and the people that live in them and the decisions that we make on a daily basis. And then I realized that we needed a lot of people to solve this problem. So for me, I drove internally at the ABC to get some key people on board, including Nate, to help actually write and develop those weather events and be the voice of the weather events as well, but really shape the narrative of like how we were going to describe these weather events, what's really important, what weather phenomena are in them, why are we going to do heat waves and bushfires and severe storms? Designing, I guess, the town specifically came about with actually approaching CSIRO. So we have seven different scientists from all different types of science backgrounds that helped us not only build the town, so the actual town itself is built to be resilient. So we've got things in there that actually make it resilient, but also they helped us develop and conceive the adaptation. So another senior science reporter, Janelle, helped also research and write those scenes. So it was a very collaborative approach. And then the Bureau came on board as well. So we had Di, another meteorologist, also work in those workshops. I think also what we realized pretty quickly is that we needed to reach out beyond just that core team as well, because it's such a complex it's like there's so many complex problems and it's such a huge thing to tackle, like reimagining how we live. And getting that tone and the narrative and the messaging correct. So we got, yourself included, but also, we just were talking about Jess Miller from the City of Sydney. We had ex-fire chief Mark Crosweller. We had Oliver Costello from Fire Sticks Alliance, who helped us in the end design and build a cultural burning scene. And Ursula Jovic narrated the story for us as well. We really wanted a warm sort of female voice to help carry us along on the journey. So even down to two artists we had involved in the end, Reg Mombasa's artwork scattered through the town, and Black Douglas's Indigenous concept also helped inform some of the Indigenous storytelling elements as well, so we could make sure that we're authentically telling that historical component that's in the series itself. In the end, it was a huge collaborative approach.
Huge.
I tried as hard as possible to bring everyone along on the journey. I think, you know, what we realized pretty quickly with our production partner Foria is AR is a new medium. So we had so many technical complexities to solve as well. So it wasn't, you know, just like making a film where we could send out rough cuts and go, hey, what does everyone think of this? Or, you know, we had to develop storyboards in collaboration and feed that into design and tech pipelines to see if things were going to work. How could we visualize this? And so it really was. And then on Foria's end, they have like a team of 10x, more than 10 people from 3D modelers, sound designers, you know, all sorts of different types of people helping to actually build the town itself. So
yeah,
lots of people have touched this project. But I think then in the end, it's become a really, it's very interrogated. So I think nearly everyone from a scientific point of view, especially, has been quite happy with the messaging, particularly, and the solutions that we've put forward. So we can kind of like hand on heart say that we tried as hard as possible to include as many people as possible, almost to the detriment because we had so many people.
Yeah.
Deciphering all those messages, right? Then making sure that they were going to be engaging and entertaining and interesting to audience as well. And then make sure the visuals are really great too, like fire tornadoes and hail and lightning and all that sort of stuff that actually people love the most in the end anyway.
Yeah. And the audio is really great as well. It's really immersive.
Yeah, yeah, there's a great sound designer, Josh, that worked on that. So
yeah, I just want to go back to speaking about AR, because maybe some of the listeners don't know that stands for augmented reality. And that is something that I didn't know about until you kind of pulled me into this amazing project. Can you just tell us what AR is?
Yeah, so, I mean, very simply, and I think people get and use VR and AR quite similarly, but really AR is just a digital layer in your real world. So think of it as like content, whether that's 3D models or text or whatever it is. You know, people, AR is like Pokemon Go or even your face filters on Instagram, that's AR.
It's
putting content into your real world to change that environment. And so for Mount Resilience, we developed a 3D model of a town to pop up on your living room so that then you could walk around and explore and be fully immersed in that story. VR, in comparison, is, you know, you'd need headsets or goggles to then be fully 360 immersed in a new environment. So it's not the real world, if that makes sense. And there's all different types of, you know, terminology that's used, like XR, which sort of like describes all different types of immersive media. I tend to use the word immersive media, like immersive storytelling, which is different to 2D storytelling or audio storytelling. But for me, AR particularly was really great because it just is so accessible. Like all you need is your mobile phone. And ABC, it was really important to make sure that we could access as many people as possible, rather than, you know, forcing people to either buy gear or attend. And great with COVID as well, because so many people aren't able to get out of the house.
Yeah.
A living room exhibition in a way, so we've sort of presented it like that.
Yeah, but
actually in this case the what Foria managed to do was use some really cutting edge technology, because you know, if you're using augmented reality, typically like if you're using Snapchat or a Facebook filter or something like that, like you've downloaded something onto your phone and there's data that is on your device. But in this case, it's a website. It's web AR. So everything is happening just by going to www.abc.net.au/mountresilience. Like you don't have to download a thing. So the barrier for entry is really, really low. You don't have to download anything. It works on a really wide range of devices, and it's so engaging. As soon as people, I've seen people using it for the first time. It's kind of funny because like when they first pull it up, it looks really cool. They're like, oh, wow. And just watching them, eventually they realize that if they, you know, lean in towards the thing, they can get closer and they can make it bigger. And next minute, you know, they're standing next to a massive fire tornado or you know, almost at the front door of a building. And they get really excited because it's something so playful and engaging. And that's what's really cool about it.
Yeah, yeah. And it makes you think, like, what is the future of technology in terms of, like, where it can bring, where it can engage more people with science communication.
Mm. Yeah. And just, like, you know, selfishly as a content maker, I love it because audiences are completely immersed. They can't check their Instagram at the same time, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can't have the TV on in the background. Well, they could because it's in their living room. But it is... Yeah, it's immersive. So, you know, the aim of it is to fully immerse people in that story and engage them end to end.
Mm. And Nate, so you were on the team of meteorologists developing this. How did you decide which extreme weather events to incorporate into Mount Resilience?
Actually, we didn't. We got pulled back completely.
What do you mean?
Well, because, you know, at the very start when they're saying, oh, what sort of extreme weather? I was like, well, let me tell you. And we had a huge list. Yeah. So what we ended up with, like, we had to pull it back, obviously, for because to recreate all of the sort of weather we wanted to, this project would have probably taken about 15 years. We turned out that we ended up discussing what most people are most likely to see. So the weather, especially as we move further into a changed climate, the weather that's in the app is something that most Australians and, in fact, the majority of people around the world are going to have to put up with. Like originally we wanted to have cyclones as well. And who knows what the future will hold. But even in a changed climate, the effect of cyclones will move further south out of the tropics a little bit, but there will still be people, say, in Tasmania that will, it's incredibly unlikely. In fact, I can't imagine a situation because cyclones themselves require the physics of being in the tropics on the globe for them to work. Once they get that far south, they transition to an extratropical cyclone, and then their effects look a little bit more like a severe storm, which is in the Mount Resilience. So we just kind of landed on things that the vast majority of people and the vast majority of communities are going to have to deal with in one way or another.
Mm, okay. And so there's fires, extreme storms. What's the other one?
So we have heat waves and bushfires, one episode basically. So we combined those two. We had actually a lot of pushback on heat waves. A lot of particularly climate scientists wanted to separate that out because heat waves, they're probably the most dangerous weather event to humans, particularly in Australia. But we just, from a visual point of view, it was actually really hard to tell that story. So we had to include it in one. And I think we managed to do it. So the adaptations that are presented after that fire goes through the town includes heat waves and smoke and fires. So it's sort of like it's encompassing everything that happens during that. And we also then with similar, like exactly what Nate said, like we really would have loved to have had cyclones because everyone loves cyclones. They just do. Like you mentioned cyclones, people are like, where, what?
Yeah, I mean, including me. I have this problem on telly and I really don't mean to. It's something I've got to be careful of. Because meteorologically they are so interesting and such a challenge to get right.
That, why are they so interesting meteorologically?
Well, because they're huge structures, like really massive structures. And even when they make landfall, the strongest cyclones are typically so strong that we can't even observe them properly because they wreck the equipment that we use to observe them. It's just really interesting. And the way they move and how they move and the way they interact, it involves like all levels of the atmosphere. There's so much going on. But so when there is a cyclone, I have to really temper my excitement as a meteorologist when I'm telling, because they're obviously very dangerous. Right?
Yes.
And I don't want to trivialize that by getting too excited and being like, but look how it's moving. I've got to keep it just a little bit more contained. But the thing is with these, like Em was saying, like we wanted, well, some people and me included, you want to separate out heat waves and bushfires, but they do kind of live together well. And same in severe storms, like there's so much going on. It's not only the storm itself, which creates heavy rainfall and you know, flash flooding and hail and all of that, but also damaging winds. That could also have sat separately. And coastal erosion, that could sit separately as well as its own thing caused by a distant weather event. But they all sort of sat together well too. Mm-hmm. So we could tell a story that was a little bit more like, hey, these are all of the possible things, and you could go down the path for whatever it was that interested you or affected your community.
Mm. And from a storytelling point of view, it was a nice yin and yang as well, sort of like that heat, the cool and the heat. We've got the two weather events hit different parts of town as well, from the left-hand side to the right-hand side. And then we just had to make sure we actually, in determining those weather events, we also then had to work backwards to make sure that the solutions and the adaptations that we were presenting were not only interesting, but also, I guess, tapping into the solutions that we need to look at going forward into the future. So as Nate said, like, okay, this severe storm needs to include coastal erosion. We all live on the coast. Why we need to deal with that, particularly as a whole animation. And then similarly, as I said before, in the heatwave scene, like, we needed to look at the impacts of heat and smoke in, you know, not just regional, not just people that are actually at the forefront of fires, you know, people living in cities. Like, after the last summer, you know, we all were affected by the impacts of smoke, and how can we be more resilient to that? So yeah, it was impacted then the solutions that we had to sort of choose. So it was this huge puzzle piece together and making sure that we were hitting all the right notes, really.
Yeah.
The way that Mount Resilience is designed as well, like, even if you don't happen to live on in a beachside property where coastal erosion is immediately going to affect you, Mount Resilience has parts of the town that are further inland, and that so might represent somebody from regional Australia who's out in the middle, you know, and dealing with a slightly different type of weather. But you can see how it all connects.
Mm. And big weather is really something that affects everyone. Like, you're not, no one is immune to a horrible big storm or bushfires or a big smoke storm. Or even if you're not going to be affected by the fires themselves because you're in a city, you're going to be affected by the heat wave that comes along with that kind of like weather that surrounds like fire seasons. So yeah, what I kind of found with this AR experience is that it's engaging and it's educational, but it's also like, it's almost like a toolkit on how to survive these things. Like, oh, okay, I live close to a coast. Oh, that's some things that I can do to kind of prepare myself, which is really lovely to see that kind of coinciding with big weather, the show, because that is kind of what that whole messaging is. It's like, we live in a country where there is big weather, but we don't need to be scared because there are things that we can do.
Yeah. And it's something actually that we had in the intro, basically, of the narrative, that there was a bit of a moment, Nate, and I remember talking to you about this, like, mm-hmm. I had a bit of an alarm go off in my head when we were writing the scripts, that, you know, instead of fighting extreme weather, we need to learn how to make room for extreme weather in our lives. So how can we actually be more prepared and then actually live with it rather than, and Oliver Costello as well and Mark Croswell were just part of a workshop that I particularly ran, but it was something that I think audiences have, and we have fed back on that narrative as well, is that, you know, it's not about, I guess, fighting, you know, it's actually about thinking about how can we live more harmoniously with these amazing fire, storm events, so that we can actually survive and thrive into the future with some of those smaller changes like you were just talking about in terms of like your immediate community, to some of the more systemic, bigger changes that we can also have influence on, you know, in our governments and in the way that we live.
And it's about going to experts so that we could give that knowledge to other people, you know, give them the language. Because you might not know that there are ways that we can do things like deal with floods. Like, you personally might want to sandbag your house, but in order for your community to be able to deal with it, you might need to look at the different ways of drainage or other larger, you know, things that you can deal with. So if that's something your community is having to put up with, you know, you can go to the people who make those decisions and maybe have some more feathers in your cap, you know, some more tools that you can use, and some words that you might not otherwise have known.
Yeah, and a lot of these solutions that Mount Resilience is suggesting goes hand in hand with making our urban space more sustainable as well. Like you just said, yeah, if it's flooding, you could sandbag your house, or you could look into water-sensitive urban design that kind of funnels and harvests rainwater in a way that it doesn't, you know, flood, like get rid of all of the, or not get rid of, but, you know, try and remove the concrete surfaces and replace it with pebbles that makes it more of a sponge and it absorbs and Yeah.
Similarly, cultural burning, you know, like the using the Indigenous techniques to manage the land can help not only make it grow better, but also reduce bushfires. And so, you know, it's not just about putting up a big wall and closing yourself and letting the world outside do what it's doing. It's about responding to the environment and living well within it.
Mm. Nate, I have a bit of a meteorology question.
I'm here for it.
Are you able to kind of break down in a very simple way how our changing climate and kind of our warming climate is affecting our weather patterns in a way that we have these more frequent big weather events?
Yes. It's all about energy in the system. That's all it's about. More heat, sure, it increases the temperature on a thermometer, but what that is really doing is leaving more potential in the atmosphere for big changes. And it's just like having a pot of water on the stove, right? If you've got a pot of cold water, you can't see it, but there are currents going on. If you've just filled it up from the tap, there are little currents going on in there all the time, and until it's sat there long enough to settle. But let's just imagine you've just filled up the pot, and they're just kind of doing their thing. Now, if you add heat, more heat, and more heat, and eventually it'll start to bubble a little bit, right? That extra heat has provided a potential difference, right, between the warmth at the bottom of the pot and the top, and so the currents get bigger and eventually bubble. If you keep adding heat, eventually it boils and that water turns to steam. That sort of more vigorous action and flow is the result of more energy in the system. And that's essentially the same thing that's happening to the atmosphere. Now, I'm not saying that the atmosphere is boiling, right? Mm. But more energy just means that the same processes are happening, but they can happen a little bit more explosively, and you can create bigger storms. And also more heat in the atmosphere means that like hotter air can hold more water. So that means there's more moisture available to get rid of in a massive storm and a massive downpour. It's really an energy problem. And when you've got more energy in the system, it can do more work. And that really just means bigger weather.
Yeah, right. Because it is a bit of a myth that people might think, oh, global warming will mean it'll just be really hot.
Yeah.
And that might kind of make them think, oh, it's just going to be sunny all the time and like maybe like around 35 degrees all the time. But actually, I've read in certain parts of the world, it will actually become wetter.
Well, yeah, and colder for some as well at times of the year. Like we've all heard about the very American polar vortex. Like that's you know, where these big lobes essentially of cold Arctic, or in our case Antarctic air, move further away from the poles. And that's because there's more energy in the system, right? So you can push colder air further north or further south than you've ever had to before. And like the wetter thing, that's largely linked to, you know, that slightly warmer air being able to hold quite a lot more water vapor as water vapor. I mean, you can think about it like, you know, a foggy morning. Once that air starts to heat up, the fog dissipates, and that's because the air itself can hold more water vapor, so it can evaporate the tiny little water droplets that make up fog. So that helps to clear the fog away so you can see through it. Water vapor is still there. It's just held in the air as vapor rather than as a liquid. And once that happens, if you then shove that air that's full of more water vapor high up in the atmosphere, it can create a cloud and then create a downpour, which for some places means they'll end up with more average annual rainfall than they did in the previous climate.
Mm, that's so interesting. I've always had a question. This is just really off top. Well, not really off topic, but off what we're trying to talk about. What is the difference between mist and fog?
How far you can see through it.
Oh, okay. It is that. It's because I saw that on Google. I was like, surely not.
Yeah. Lying. No, it's just a visibility thing. And there's also no difference really between a fog and a cloud. It's just fog is a cloud on the ground.
I remember you telling me that. Hmm. You should watch Weird Weather on YouTube, Tessa.
Oh, yeah.
Nate and I did ages ago.
Yeah, Emma's actually got really good form on weather stuff. We've worked together on a couple of it was Weird Weather and Colourful Weather, a couple of series on YouTube.
I will. It sounds amazing. Yeah, there's so many weird weather things that happen. I remember one year when I was living in LA, they have this thing kind of like through June. They call it June gloom. Have you ever heard about it?
I haven't. Tell me.
I think it's before it gets really hot in summer. They just get like all of their coastal beaches just get absolutely covered in fog. And you can't see, like it is definitely fog, not mist, because you can't see more than like 2 meters in front of you. It's just like, but it's crazy because you'll be in East LA, like around Echo Park or whatever. And it's completely, it's like you're in a desert, blue skies, swelteringly hot. And then you drive for an hour and a half, get to the beach, and it's like you're in a completely different world. It was just insane.
So and that would be because the warmer air holds more water vapor, but then clear skies overhead because you're getting to summer, so probably more high pressure systems. That lets the heat out at night. So now you've got this air that is full of moisture that's cooling down. And remember, warm air can hold more moisture. That means cool air can hold less moisture. Clear skies means the heat's escaping. So the air cools down, can hold less and less moisture. And what does that have to do? It can't stay as a gas anymore. It has to turn into a liquid.
Mm.
And forms these tiny little droplets. Mm. And that's your fog.
Yeah. I have another question. It's kind of about El Nino and La Nina, because I've heard that floating around a bit lately, and I've heard that we are now in, we've gone from El Nino, which is more like drought, into a La Nina. And I'm curious, is that something completely separate to like big weather events and a changing climate? How does it all work?
It's not completely separate at all. So the El Nino and La Nina form the what's called ENSO, the El Nino Southern Oscillation. It's something that happens in the Southern Pacific Ocean, and it's to do with the trade winds, essentially the winds that go from South America to Northern Australia. They travel from the southeast to the northwest across the Pacific, and they carry moisture with them. In El Nino years, the winds are a little bit weaker, and so the moisture that's picked up by those winds over near South America ends up forming clouds and raining on the ocean in the middle of the Pacific. Whereas in La Nina years, the winds are a bit stronger and that gets pushed all the way over to Australia. Also, the ocean, the surface temperature of the ocean, which is another major factor in determining whether it's happening. When those winds are stronger, the warmer waters get pushed away from South America into the middle of the Pacific. And that's where a lot of the evaporation is happening. So when those winds are stronger, all of the tropically rainy stuff just gets shifted towards our side of the Pacific. So we end up with more rain events, greater likelihood of flooding because of those rain events. Slightly more cyclones than average. And when it's El Nino, that all shifts back towards South America. And so all of that rain is happening over the Pacific and we end up with not much coming in to the East Coast. Because, you know, we often think of the weather coming from the west to the east, but that's only through the mid-latitudes, so south of the tropics. So that's where our major population centres are, from Perth through Adelaide and Sydney. Brisbane's sort of on the middle bit. It gets a lot of easterly weather, but anything north of there, it's all coming from the east, not from the west.
And how many years do these things take to, like, switch?
Ooh, it varies. It's kind of all over the shop. Like this year, La Niñas typically don't last very long. Like this year we're in a pretty strong one, but it's probably going to end February or March.
Okay.
Every now and then they happen to go for a couple of years. And El Nino is the same, except it seems like El Ninos are becoming a little bit more frequent and lasting a little bit longer and being a bit stronger. You know, millennium drought, the drought we just went through.
Yeah. And is that due to a change in climate?
It's likely affected by it, yeah.
Yeah.
It's really hard because it really depends on the ocean temperatures. And we haven't been recording them for all that long. So we don't have a great record way back in the past. Reasonably good one. We can infer a lot. But there's good evidence to suggest that there is a strong climate signal in there, but it's hard to pick out exactly how much, although universities are working really hard and they're getting really good at attribution studies.
Yeah. And you said something about water temp. I'm a surfer, so I really do want to know, is the water going to get colder or warmer with this La Niña?
Oh, which side of the Pacific are you thinking about? So the stronger winds mean that we've got warmer waters over on our side of the ocean. And that means because the winds are pushing it along, there's actually upwelling on the other side of the Pacific. So colder waters are coming up from deep in the ocean over on the eastern Pacific. And we're getting these warm surface waters that have been on top of the ocean for a long time, being heated by the sun, moving over towards us. So for now, along the east coast, it's probably going to be warming up.
Nice. I love that.
Oh, it's nice for some, not great for coral reefs. Because you know as well. Yeah, you know as well.
That's what a horrible thing for me to say. I'm so selfish. Like well, momentarily.
Whether you want to wear a wetsuit or not, Tessa.
Yeah, if I want to look cute in the surf this summer. Like totally forgot about coral bleaching.
Joe, all of the same things, well, most of the same things that happen in the atmosphere, like cold fronts, warm fronts, and cyclones, the equivalent happens in the ocean because it's all fluids, right? Water and air, both fluids, and there's temperature differentials. The ocean gets a bit more complicated because there's salinity, there's the halo climb, that's the change in salt through the layers of the ocean. But essentially, very similar things happen both in the air and in the ocean. It's just the ocean's really slow. But it's super interesting. Warm fronts in the ocean. Who knew?
Yeah. What I always find really curious is when it's a north swell on the east coast, we tend to get the colder water, whereas if it's a south swell, it seems to be warmer. I don't know why. I think something about, like, you know, if you get like a big northeast swell, it always like seems to bring these like currents of water that are freezing cold, but it's usually a high pressure system because it's like nice weather, but then like this beautiful like northeast swell, which is like pretty good. And then it's like cold water for some reason. And then always south swell seems to be a bit warmer.
I wonder why. I'll have to have a deeper think about that.
It might
be like when you get the south easterly swell, but that's pretty rare along the east coast, unless you've got a low pressure system out there in the Tasman, in which case maybe it's pulling some, because the low pressure systems go clockwise, maybe it's pulling some of the warmer water around it and making like a tongue of warm water that comes down from the north and around the bottom of the low, whereas if you've got a northerly, what's going to be causing that? That's a high pressure system, so maybe it's going anti-clockwise and pulling up a tongue of colder water from the south and pushing it onto the east coast. I haven't thought about that because I don't surf, but I'll dig in.
It's off topic. I'm sorry. Let's get back on topic. let's get back to Mount Resilience, because I'm really interested to talk, Emma, a bit about where you think that this kind of use of like AR can go in the future, because this isn't the first time that you have used kind of immersive technology to do storytelling. What's so alluring about this medium? You've kind of already spoken to that, but where do you think, where's an exciting future prospect for it?
I mean, I think the next biggest thing, particularly for VR and AR, well, it's not the next biggest thing, it's the thing where I guess it's working really well, is the education sector. So it is a really good education tool to use to immerse people. But for me, as like a doco maker, I love being able to take people places that they would otherwise never go. So but that's probably more VR. You know, it could be used in AR really as well. But the ability, you know, and you think of audiences as well that can't go anywhere, you know, whether they're hindered by socioeconomic or ability or whatever, the ability to take them. I had a story, and it's still in the pipeline, about rising sea levels in the Solomon Islands, and the ability to take someone sitting, you know, at home who's never traveled outside of Australia to go and meet villagers and hear their firsthand stories and be immersed in their visual world. And the quality now of video content that can be streamed via headsets is just unbelievable. It feels so real. And I just think from an impact and a storytelling point of view, as a storyteller, like that to me is so exciting, to be able to get people's stories across to audiences in meaningful ways that actually might create more impact rather than, you know, Netflix when people are actually surfing Facebook or Instagram, or Insta when they're actually watching Netflix. And, you know, it's not as widely accessible. So it's such a small niche market at the moment, like in terms of doco VR storytelling and AR. But Mount Resilience, I think particularly, like, we were trying to bridge that gap, it's not bridge the gap, but it's basically like try and tell a compelling story that's really an education piece as well in AR, and make it engaging. But, you know, Foria particularly did such a great job of making it look beautiful as well and engaging, and the visuals really speak for itself. So I think that by taking audiences into worlds, you know, whether it's like fictional, which is Mount Resilience, or real, you know, like that story in the Solomon Islands, like it does give people the time to just dream about something other than the reality that they're in. So for me, immersive media particularly, it just takes people out of their reality. And for whatever reason, like if it's an education component, or if it's, you know, taking people, even, you know, it's used in nursing homes to transport the elderly to holiday destinations that they would otherwise not go to. It's used for all sorts of different stuff. The obvious one being the porn industry as well. It is the number one industry where it really has taken off because there's such a demand.
Wow.
Particularly, like as Nate was talking about before, like what is groundbreaking about Mount Resilience is the ability for it to be delivered via the web. So web AR and web VR means that, you know, we no longer need to download an app to experience AR or VR. And we have actually built Mount Resilience in a way that it can be distributed as a web VR experience as well. So you could actually be completely immersed in Mount Resilience, the town itself. Mm. That would be, you know, phase two, if we can, you know, raise more money to take it into that phase. Yeah, but I think just as a storyteller particularly, I love those two components of it the most. And I know Nate's loved it as well. Like, you know, dreaming up a weather event, you know, as he's obviously obsessed with the weather, as I am a bit too, but just being able to dream up a fire tornado and have it in your living room, I think was all I needed to say to Nate, do you want to be part of this project? I think sold him on that, right?
Absolutely. And like to be able to have an actual thunderstorm. And like when we were very first talking about it, and they're like, yeah, well, it can be as big. And like, how big are they? I was like, what? We can make a real one? Yeah. I was so excited. So excited. The only problem we've got at the moment when it comes to things like AR and VR is getting people like used to it. Because I think people are a little bit nervy about it. And that's what I love about Mount Resilience. It feels like it's almost cartoony, but in a realistic way. It looks like something you just want to muck about.
Yeah, it certainly does. And you do. Guys, I saw that great when you guys launched that fun video of you kind of using it in the studio, Nate. It was very it rubbed off. It was very engaging.
Yeah, and that's the sort of thing you need to, you know, get people typically, I'm talking to you as a science communicator, people are often have difficulty engaging with stuff, even if they really need to, you know, because of their circumstances, need to know information. Sometimes people can think, oh, it's a bit too hard or a bit too much or it's a bit too complicated. And so something like this that really makes it simple and brings it into your, like, into your space and puts you in charge, and you can get the bushfire going, for example, and decide that you're bored and not really interested, and like go over there and have a look at that building, and you know, you sort of direct your experience in it, which is really great, and a way for people to get used to stuff like AR and VR, which is definitely, like, I'm a huge fan, not for the porn industry reasons, but for the, you know, the getting around the world and experiencing stuff, I love it.
Yeah,
and I think it's good that we're finding fun, engaging ways, you know, this early on to get people involved, because it's going to be a heck of a lot more of it in the future.
Yeah, for sure. Even just with like getting people to kind of like understand how amazing certain parts of the natural world are in order for them to kind of appreciate it. Like I remember as a kid going to IMAX was like the absolute shit. Like if mum said, we're going to IMAX, we're going to watch an underwater film, I'd be like, levitating. You know,
that's how I feel about this because it's weather, right? I'm like, and I narrated the thing. Could you think I can do Mount Resilience? I've done it so many times. I've made the weather happen so many times. Do you think I can do it without like mouthing along? I'm like, the heat is so intense. It's fire tornado. Like I say it every time because I get so excited.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so much fun.
Very fun. So Ems, where can you do the plug? How can we how can people experience Mount Resilience in all its glory?
Simply go to abc.net.au / Mount Resilience, and that's MT Resilience.
MT Resilience.
Yeah, so AR works on mobile. We do have a desktop version, so if you don't have a mobile, we wanted to make sure that other people could have a look at that, at the experience as well. And that's just using your keyboard and your mouse to click around and have a look. But AR is through a mobile. So most newer devices are compatible. So we're sort of looking at like iPhone 7 and above, and nearly all Android phones can access it. And you simply use your phone like a window through to Mount Resilience. So it really is like a portal, like your camera feed basically opens up and it's like a portal to Mount Resilience.
So cool. Everyone must try. It's absolutely, yeah, a very, very fun and engaging new way to experience big weather if we're not already experiencing it outside our windows. Thanks so much, you guys, for, you know, spending an hour of your day discussing big weather with me. I really appreciate it.
We both love it, so it wasn't hard.
Yeah. I can't believe you're cutting me off this quickly. I've got so much more to say about the weather.
Oh, really? What? Yeah. It's an hour. I feel like it's time.
All right. Well, next time you've got a question, let me know.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll have you back on next time we hit a big weather event.
What millimeter wetsuit you want to wear.
Yeah. That was Big Weather with Nathan Byrne and Emma Morris. Such a cool conversation. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe and follow the Instagram account at the Nature Between Us podcast. And that's it. I was about to say .com, but that doesn't make sense. I don't have a website. I just have an Instagram. Catch you next time.